You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Visit bpn.fm to discover more.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24, Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to 30 to Curtain, a Center Theater Group podcast. I'm Doug Baker, Center Theater Group's producing director, and I'll be your guest host for this episode. Through my role at the organization, I work closely with artistic director Michael Ritchie to bring productions to our three theaters, the Amundsen Theater, Mark Taper Forum, and Kirk Douglas Theater. Our guest on this episode of 30 to Curtain is James Lapine, who's the writer and director of Falsettos, which is on stage at the Amundsen Theater, April 16 through May 19, 2019. James is a multiple Tony Award winning writer and director, having helped create such Broadway classic musicals as Sunday in the Park with George, Into the Woods, Passion, and the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee. He is a longtime collaborator with composers Stephen Sondheim and William Finn. Simply put, James Lapine is a Broadway legend, and we're honored to have him here at Center Theater Group to discuss his Tony-nominated revival of Falsettos and the musical's intriguing history. I hope you enjoy the conversation, and we look forward to seeing you at the theater. We are thrilled to have James Lapine back with Center Theater Group with Falsettos. We first brought this important work to Los Angeles audiences in 1994 at the Doolittle Theater. In fact, we were the Amundsen at the Doolittle in those days. James, I thought it might be fun for us to think back to that production just for a moment before we talk about some other things, and just run through some of our memories of that production. My recollection of that production is, with your support and guidance, CTG was able to reassemble the original cast. And we had, as I recall, pretty much the entire original cast, including the amazing Michael Rupert, Stephen Bogardus, Chip Zine, Barbara Walsh, Heather McRae, and Carolee Carmello. What are some of your memories, recollections of that production?
Well, in about 1978, Bill Finn and I were both working at Playwrights Horizons, which was a burgeoning off-Broadway theater before off-Broadway had really exploded the way it has now. And I was a bit of a neophyte at the time, did my first play ever there called Table Settings, and he did a one-act musical called In Trousers with a character named Marvin at the center. And Andre Bishop, who ran the theater, introduced us and suggested that we work together. And Bill had been noodling around with a sequel to In Trousers, which was originally called Four Jews in a Room Bitching. He asked me if I would direct it, having really only done about two or three plays in my whole life and never having done a musical. Of course, I said yes. And we started, as in those days, it was so different. There was a little 90-seat theater they had upstairs. And Andre just said, well, I'll give you a month to develop your show and a month to put it on. And so we started really basically with just about four songs and four characters. And I was the one who suggested that he introduce the child, the bar mitzvah boy, Jason, into the proceedings. And basically, I helped develop the storyline with Bill, and we worked closely together and took those four songs and worked outward from there and created what's essentially now the first act of Falsettos, and that was called, as I'd mentioned, March of the Falsettos. And fortunately, it was a wonderful success and moved to a couple of theaters and had a lovely life.
You even had a tour, as I recall. And
yeah, I think we were in L.A.
Yes,
at the Doolittle.
And
just
the Doolittle.
March of the Falsettos,
yes.
Right.
Right.
And
in those days, it was the Huntington Hartford. It hadn't
really
named the Doolittle yet.
Uh-huh.
Jimmy Doolittle was running the theater. It wasn't until later that
it became
the Doolittle. Yes, it was the
Huntington
Hartford.
By the way, is it still in existence, the theater?
It is. It is now the Ricardo Montalban Theater.
Uh-huh.
And is run by an organization known as Nosotros.
Oh, excellent. It's wonderful how theater is really growing and continuing to grow in L.A. We were in our very early, almost 30. I think we were about late 20s about that time. And we worked with Michael Rupert, Chip Zion, and Stephen Bogardus at the time. And as the 80s hit us, particularly the AIDS crisis, several years later, Bill and I started thinking, well, what happened to these people? And we then, at the end of the 70s, started working on what became Falsetto Land, or a sequel to March of the Falsettos. We regrouped and got the same players together again. And the show is actually only set 2 years later than the original. So we didn't want to put it in the AIDS crisis in the middle of it. We did it just at that moment when it was coming into people's consciousness.
Yes.
And that production went very well, was very well received, had also an independent run of its own. And then eventually Hartford Stage, it was always our hope and intention of putting the two together. And Hartford Stage did that with a completely new production by Graziella Danielle. Renamed Falsettos, and it did so well, and a Broadway producer came along, and it was a very difficult decision, but Bill decided to ultimately go back to the original team to mount it on Broadway, and that's the 1994 production. And then I would say about 3 years ago, I was at a benefit at the Public Theater, and I happened to be sitting next to a theater owner, Jordan Roth, who owns Jujamson Theaters. I had never met him, and we were making small talk as one does, and I just casually asked him, what's on your bucket list? You know, what do you really, really want to produce? And he just said, funny, you should ask, Falsettos. And I said, okay, I'm in, let's do it. And he conjoined with Lincoln Center Theater, because before we would do it with them, we had to say, you know, we really owe it to Andre Bishop, who got the whole ball rolling and produced those first two shows.
When he was a playwright.
When he was
now,
a playwright.
Of course, having run Lincoln Center Theater Company for many, many years.
Right. And they wanted to be involved. So Jordan and Lincoln Center produced it on Broadway. And here we are in Los Angeles.
And that's when I saw it.
Uh-huh.
And expressed our interest have it returned to Los Angeles. You know, I was checking dates, James, and in fact, it was not just 25 years ago that the production played Amundsen and the Doolittle, but 25 years ago this month.
Wow.
We are, I think, literally 2 weeks away from it being precisely 25 years.
That's
so
wild.
You can refer to this as our 25th anniversary.
Oh, boy, production. It makes me feel old, but I'm happy, though, that I can be here.
You look very well.
Well, thank you. Podcasts do me justice. You don't have to look at me. You know, it's sort of interesting, though. It was a bit of a crapshoot because we weren't sure just how it would play. Sadly, one of the reasons I wanted to do it was I was a 23-year-old assistant who had graduated from NYU in theater, and I took her to see The Normal Heart, which was being revived on Broadway. And at intermission, she just looked at me and said, well, I kind of know about the AIDS epidemic, but was it really like this? And I thought, oh, boy, you know.
That's powerful.
That's a reason to do these shows, to remind people of what we went through and what existed. And it's part of our history. And but we weren't sure how this one was going to play. And it was just kind of a thrill because we had certain people who were coming back to see it, who had seen it originally, people who brought their kids back because they wanted them to see it, and a whole new generation of people who knew nothing about it and frankly, nothing about the era. And it doesn't really matter. Oddly enough, it feels so contemporary. And the HIV part of it is actually kind of a small part. It's really a story about people struggling to figure out who they are and their sexual identity and how they fit into the world and how you raise a kid and what you teach your children and how you grow, et cetera. And that was maybe the most heartening thing of all about reviving the show.
I was struck when I saw the preview last evening by, in particular, the song that the character Trina sings just before the March of the Falsettos number, where she's singing about the men in the world and how much control men have in the world. I'm not remembering the lyric exactly.
Yeah.
You could help us with that. But that struck me as a song, a thought, a comment so current for what we're going through.
Totally.
Right now.
She is the only female in the first act. And she very much represented a kind of woman back, which existed in the 70s, you know, women I knew and grew up with who ended up getting married very young and having children and not really being part of the feminist movement until the feminist movement took hold and questioning their lives and their relationship with men and the mothers that raised them to be subservient to men and to not have careers of their own and whatnot. So that song is so potent today to listen to and hasn't really lost its power.
Very much so.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
I'd like to go back to what you mentioned earlier regarding how you came to the theater.
Ah, okay.
Am I correct that you were trained as a graphic designer and worked as a graphic designer for the early part of your career?
Correct. In fact, I got my MFA at CalArts and actually with more of a concentration in photography. Which was what I hoped to make as a career. But I also took several graphic design courses because it interested me. And I also love art. And left California to go back to New York and had, you know, the usual odd jobs and was doing freelance photography work. And I really didn't enjoy freelancing as a photographer. Actually, I found it extremely stressful because this was pre-digital era, ladies and gentlemen. And when you were on assignment, you know, to go out and take a photo of whatever and bring it, run it over to New York Magazine or Village Voice where I was working, you didn't know what you had. You had to run into the dark room. You had to process it, hope it worked out. So I kind of segued over into graphic design because it to keep my photography kind of pure. I really had hoped to be a fine art photographer. And that's when I began doing more graphic design work, which oddly enough led me in a peculiar way to the theater, because I was hired by Yale University School of Drama to design their magazine, which was called Yale Theater. I won't bore you with how that happened, but it was just a freelance job. But by doing that, Bob Brustein, who ran the dean of the school, loved what I had done with the magazine and created a full-time position for me at Yale. So I left New York and went to work at the university and taught a class in advertising design for the students in the theater who were studying management, basically. And Bob Brustein did something interesting. In the month of January, he asked everyone in the school to take, I think it was 2 weeks or something, hiatus to do something outside of their area of expertise. So the actors had to build the sets, professors involved as well were writing plays, I thought a brilliant way to get people out of their comfort zone and feel what it's like to be on the other side of what they're doing. And my graphic design students said, you should direct a play, because my interest in theater at that point was very, very downtown, arty, Robert Wilson, Richard Foreman, which was not in vogue at the Yale School of Drama. So they found that very interesting. So I said, well, if you find me a play, I'll direct it. And one of the students found a play called Photograph. Well, of course, the title immediately got me, and it was by Gertrude Stein, and it was a five-act play, but it was only 3 pages long.
Goodness.
So I thought, well, this will be interesting. And we did it as a theme and variation, meaning that we did it about, I don't know, 8 times over and over and over again in very different ways, one of which was my fascination with the painting Sunday on the Island of Le Grand Jatte by Seurat. So that was one of my 8 inspirations as a visual to do this play. And the woman who produced it was actually a stage manager. She said, you should do it in New York. And I said, well, I don't know how to do it in New York. And also, we don't have any money. And a close friend of mine was doing her dissertation for a PhD on Jasper Johns. And she said, well, you know, Jasper Johns loves Gertrude Stein. So like a yo-yo, I wrote him a letter. I said, I've got this play about Gertrude Stein. And they sent me $2,500. So we went to a loft in New York, and another friend of mine, I knew mostly people in the art world, so can I help? And I said, well, you know, I have no idea how you get people to review a show. So she just literally picked up the phone and called the lead critic of the New York Times and sweet-talked him into coming and seeing the show. And he came and saw the show and gave it a half-page rave review in the New York Times. And ironically, suddenly I had a career in the theater. So
it's fantastic.
While all these other poor people were paying all that money at Yale to learn how to direct, I went and directed something without any experience at all. So it was kind of an interesting story.
Absolutely an interesting story. Let's talk a little bit more about Bill Finn, please.
Yes.
You've worked with Bill on a number of other projects.
Yes.
Take us through some of those, please.
Well, we kind of parted after March of the Falsettos and came back together again, I think, for Falsetto Land. And I'm so old now, I can't keep track of what came what when. We worked on a show called Muscle, which I quite loved. It was about an intellectual who became a bodybuilder, Sam Fussell. It's based on his nonfiction book. And I was so fascinated with that, the mind-body thing. And so we worked on that musical. It's interesting because I remember as we were preparing it, talking to my mother-in-law about it, and she went, bodybuilders, ooh, I couldn't come. I couldn't sit. I find that really distasteful, you know? And I thought, maybe that's not such a good thing. Anyway, we tried it out in Chicago. It didn't. Unfortunately, we didn't really fly. But it was a lot of fun. And let's see, what else have we done? We
did A New Brain come next?
A New Brain was something that I came into. Bill was working on it with Graziella, and Andre Bishop was producing it. And he said, you know, to Bill, you really need a book writer in here. So I joined that production. I did not direct it, and I helped them create it and write
it. Right.
And I did get to direct it myself at Encores a couple of years ago, and it's a terrific show.
I love the score.
That happened, oddly enough, a week after Bill won two Tony Awards. And Bill's a very eccentric fellow, and we all used to just kind of discount his eccentricities as just being part of it. But it turned out he had a serious brain injury. And a week later, he was in the hospital after the Tony Awards, having major surgery. And consequently, he wrote this show, A New Brain, about his experience. And it's a wonderful show. Really, really great. And we also did 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee.
Yes.
Another one I didn't come in initially on, but was being tried out in a summer theater. And Bill asked me to come, and I took it over as a book writer. Excuse me, as a director, not a book writer. Rachel Schenken did the book, and we had a great success with that. And so Bill and I, and we did Little Miss Sunshine together. Which was my, having said I'm never going to turn a movie into a musical, I turned a movie into a musical. So there you have it. But we're great friends, and I've been very, very lucky working with him and Stephen Sondheim almost exclusively, because it's unusual to write a musical with only two people doing it. Usually you have often a book writer, a lyricist, a composer, you know, before you know it, you're sitting in a room with four people trying to put a show together. And it's really terrific when it's just two of you. It makes it much, much easier. And you can keep your vision of what you're doing clearer because you have fewer opinions being thrown your way.
I have noticed that you work that way.
Yeah.
Prefer to work that way.
Yeah.
That's
I didn't set out.
It is unique.
Just kind of turned out that.
Yeah.
That's
well, let's talk about Mr. Sondheim.
Yes.
A bit,
I always
please.
Love talking about him.
How did you meet, and what was that like?
Well, interestingly enough, I'm writing a book about that. We were, this is also an odd story. I was always fascinated with a book by Nathaniel West called A Cool Million. It's really a novella. And I thought it would be a great musical. And I spoke to a producer who I was working at the time. And he said, who do you think you could write it? And I said, Randy Newman. Because I love Randy Newman. Because I didn't really know musical theater people. It was right after Bill and I had worked. And so I came out here to L.A. and met Randy Newman, who couldn't have been more charming. And he said that he said it was too dark for him. And I thought, whoa, this is dark for Randy Newman. So Stephen Graham, who I was working with as a producer, shared an office with an elder producer, Lewis Allen, and talked to Lewis. And Lewis
Wonderful producer.
And Lewis said, what about Steve Sondheim? And Steve had just been coming off of a flop, Merrily We Row Along on Broadway. And to be honest, I really didn't know much about Stephen Sondheim. I'd only seen one of his shows, which was Sweeney Todd, because I didn't really go to the theater that much. And I said, sure, I've heard of him. I'll meet him. And that's how we were introduced. And ironically, he had seen the three shows I had done. And I think it was just kismet, you know, him coming off of a long-term working relationship with Hal Prince. And I think this offered a different way to go for him. And we met about A Cool Million, and he read it and said, you know, I love it. I forgot that it's Candide. It's basically the story of Candide. And I've already done Candide. But if you want to talk about doing another project, you know, let's keep talking. So.
And that first musical that you then collaborated on, Sunday in the Park with George.
Correct. Yeah. And it all comes together.
Here we go.
Of the, you know, we worked so differently And we'd just get together and we'd talk. And one day I brought in a bunch of images. And I said to him, I'm just going to put some images out on the floor. And we sat there and talked a little bit about them. I think he was kind of thinking, what is this? And one of the last images was the Le Grand Jatte painting by Seurat. And we talked about it. And I said, you know, look, it looks like a stage set. And the proscenium is the frame of the painting. And you know, this interesting aspect, if you notice, people aren't looking at each other, blah, blah. And he said, yeah. And I said, but there's a character missing. And he went, who? And I said, the artist. And he went, oh. And so that's how it started as an idea.
And you continued the relationship, obviously.
Yes.
I mean, Sunday in the Park with George was a huge success for good reason. And you then, I think, next up was Into the Woods.
Right, which was out here.
Out here, indeed. Well,
later, yes.
I was lucky enough at the time that Into the Woods was on Broadway. I was working with the Dodger production folks.
Right.
And every now and then I would sub in as the company manager to cover your beautiful production of Into the Woods. That was really one of my great memories of working on Broadway shows.
Oh, wonderful.
Broadway.
Yeah.
Right. And then in 2002, in fact, Dodger Productions produced The Revival, which you directed.
Right.
And we presented that at the Amundsen Theater on a pre-Broadway basis.
Yeah, we tried it out here.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then off. And that starred Vanessa Williams.
Correct.
And certainly not billed as a star, but now certainly a star, Laura Benanti.
Yes.
Was Cinderella, was she not?
That's correct.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
That was a nice cast.
Very well.
Yeah, and a nice production.
You have
too.
Quite an eye for casts, I will say that.
Thank you. I don't know quite how you, you know, first of all, you have to sing Stephen Sondheim's music. So that limits the number of people you have to choose from right off
right?
the bat.
Yes.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Particularly like a Cinderella role, which is really difficult singing part. So it does make it a little bit easier from the start because you only have X number of people who can actually sing it.
And then you moved on to Passion.
Yes.
With Stephen.
Right.
Very challenging piece.
Yes.
Would you talk a bit about that, please?
Yeah. The first two shows we generated together. And Passion was a movie, Passione d'amore, by Ettore Scola, which was an Italian film that Steve had seen that he had always wanted to do as a musical. So I watched the movie, and I have to say I was quite sure about it. And, but of course discovered that it was based on a Tarchetti novel, which was not translated, and we had it translated. And I really was taken by the novel more than the movie. And, that's what we, began doing. And in fact, initially it was going to be, 2-1 acts. It was going to be Passion and then Muscle. Because they're in an ironic way related, because Passion is about a woman who's anorexic and sickly, and Passion is about a very different kind of guy who has another kind of physical, one shrinking and the other's enlarging. Mm-hmm. And Steve, in fact, wrote the first song for Muscle, but Muscle was set in a very contemporary setting, and he just didn't feel that was his skill set musically. Also, as we worked on Passion, it kept expanding into really becoming a show unto itself. So that's how that happened. But it was an interesting and difficult, there's the J word again, journey to its birth. We didn't try it out of town or anything. In fact, it kind of rushed to Broadway rather quickly. And when we did a workshop of it with, you know, our friends and people we knew, everybody was just so excited about it and loved it so much. And of course, the minute we put it on Broadway, it was the complete opposite reception. People are like, what the hell is this? You know? And so it was a really tough preview period, finding a show that we wanted to do, but that also an audience wanted to see. And it asked a lot of an audience, that show, because it's about love. And, it asked the tough questions about love. And a lot of people, I think, didn't want to really think about that. And it's not an easy thing to think about when you get right down to it, you know, attraction, who we're attracted to, why we're attracted. It almost goes back a little bit to falsettos in that sense of what is a relationship and what's. So it was curious. It's a 19th century.
So.
Yeah, right. Like Sunday. It's around the same time in Italy in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. I'd love to see it. Well, it gets revived occasionally in New York, and I think a little bit here and there.
But you haven't gone back to.
No, I haven't. I don't know that I would either. I think I'm really tired of going back now. This thrilling and, you know, what a wonderful opportunity as it is. In fact, I was supposed to go to London after this to do falsettos. And I thought, I can't do it anymore. It's just, I've done it. At my age, I need to be doing new things. So
Well, we're very pleased you did the 2016 revival on Broadway.
Oh, I am too, actually.
Respond to this tour because
I am, of course, thrilled that I did it as well.
Frankly, I consider it a masterwork. And I mean that quite genuine.
I think it's aged really, really well, and it's still so fresh. I mean, structurally and everything about it is kind of like nothing else. It's sort of sui generis in that way, as musicals go. And I love its forward energy. It kind of just takes you along for the ride, you know.
Indeed.
If you don't get on the car right away, eventually you get sucked into it, and then it just takes off.
Well, James, thank you so much for talking with us today. Thank you so much for coming to Los Angeles to help us launch our 5-week engagement of falsettos. I'm confident our audiences are going to discover the show. For those new to it, they will discover it and be quite taken by it. And for those who are revisiting the show, they will also see the extraordinary work that you've put together.
I was so encouraged and have been when we did on Broadway too, how many young people come out for it. And I think musical theater has taken on a life of its own out there. It's wonderful. So thank you for bringing me back and bringing our show back. And, you know, I'm excited for people to see it.
You're very welcome indeed. You've been listening to 30 to Curtain, a Center Theater Group podcast. You can find out more about falsettos, our organization, and upcoming productions on our website at centertheatergroup.org.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.